You know, I was walking past a massive construction site this morning, one of those huge high-rises going up downtown, and I just stopped to watch them crane these giant steel beams into place.
Right.
And to the naked eye, steel is just static.
Yeah.
It's cold, it's gray, it's solid. It feels like a finished story.
It feels permanent, like it's just there and always will be.
Exactly.
Yeah.
But then I came home and started reading the papers for today's deep dive, and I had this realization. If I had Superman's X-ray vision, or more accurately, an electron microscope, and I looked inside that static beam, I wouldn't see something peaceful at all. I'd see a battlefield.
That is the perfect way to describe it. It is a chaotic war zone of crystals fighting for space, carbon atoms migrating around like refugees in different phases.
Finished.
Not even close.
And that is exactly where we are going today. We're doing a deep dive into a landmark paper from 1983 by HKDH Padatia and D.V. Edmonds.
A classic.
It's titled Bainite in Silicon Steel's New Composition Property Approach, Part 1.
In the world of metallurgy, this paper is basically The Empire Strikes Back. I mean, it completely changed the trajectory of the saga. It challenged assumptions that had been around for decades.
And the mission for this deep dive is pretty specific. We're going to figure out how adding a supercom element silicon allows metallurgists to rig that battlefield we just talked about.
Right.
The goal is to create a super steel that is incredibly hard,
Yeah.
but also surprisingly tough, and to do it without using a bunch of expensive rare metals.
Right. It's about solving the oldest dilemma in material science, the trade-off between strength and toughness.
Okay, let's unpack that first.
Good, okay.
Because I think in casual conversation, people use strength and toughness interchangeably.
They do all the time.
Like, oh, that's a tough truck, or that's a strong truck. But in engineering, those mean very, very different things, don't they?
Very different. Think of a ceramic plate. It's hard. It's strong in the sense that you can't scratch it easily. It resists deformation. But if you drop it,
It shatters into a million pieces.
exactly. It has zero toughness. It can't absorb energy. On the flip side, think of a paperclip.
Okay.
It's tough.
Yeah.
You can bend it back and forth 100 times without it snapping, but it's not strong. It deforms way too easily to hold up a building.
And usually with steel, you're stuck on a seesaw. If you push the strength up, the toughness goes down. You make it harder, it gets brittle. You make it tougher, it gets soft.
Precisely. For a century, metallurgists have been trying to cheat that seesaw. And this paper from 1983 proposed a radical way to do it using a microstructure called bainite.
Okay, bainite. This is a term we need to define clearly before we go further.
Right.
We aren't talking about a chemical element on the periodic table here. We're talking about an arrangement of atoms, right?
Right. It's a microstructure. So let's go back to basics. Steel is mostly iron and carbon. When you heat steel up really high, the iron atoms arrange themselves in a specific way called austenite.
Austenite, got it.
It's a face-centered cubic lattice, if you want to get technical, but for our purposes, just think of austenite as the hot, flexible phase.
Okay.
It's stable at high temperatures, and crucially, it loves carbon. It can hold a lot of carbon atoms inside its structure like a sponge.
So austenite is the starting line.
Yeah.
It's hot and it's full of carbon.
Yes. Now, as you cool the steel down, that austenite wants to transform into something else. If you cool it at a moderate rate, it transforms into bainite.
And bainite is basically what?
It's essentially plates of ferrite, which is your standard room temperature iron structure growing into the austenite.
But here's the catch that the paper highlights. Traditionally, bainite had a fatal flaw, a reason why people didn't always want to use it.
The carbides. This is the villain of our story.
The carbides, specifically something called cementite.
Cementite. See, remember I said austenite acts like a sponge for carbon? Well, ferrite is the opposite. Ferrite hates carbon. It can't hold it. So when that hot austenite transforms into bainitic ferrite, the ferrite says, I don't want this carbon. And it spits it out.
It evicts the carbon.
It creates a massive eviction crisis. In traditional steel, that rejected carbon has nowhere to go, so it clumps together with iron to form cementite carbides.
Okay.
These are hard, brittle particles that form right between the plates of steel.
And from what I gathered in the reading, having these carbides inside your steel is like having sand in your gears.
Worse, they are like microscopic cracks waiting to happen. If you stress the steel, pull it, or hit it, these carbides crack immediately. And
Oh.
once a crack starts, it propagates through the whole beam. So you might have a strong steel, but it's brittle because of these garbage byproducts.
So enter the hero of our story,
Huh.
silicon. Padicia and Edmonds didn't just pick silicon randomly.
Not all.
They knew it had a specific chemical superpower. What makes silicon so special in this context?
So this is the aha moment. Silicon has a very low solubility in cementite, in plain English.
Please.
It hates cementite. It effectively forbids cementite from forming.
It's a chemical blockade.
Exactly. Nah. If you add enough silicon, about 2% in this experiment, you create a situation where the bainite is forming, it's rejecting all this excess carbon, but the silicon is standing there like a bouncer saying, you are not allowed to form carbides.
So the carbon is homeless, it's been kicked out of the ferrite, and it's banned from forming carbides. Where does it go?
There's only one place left. It floods into the remaining untransformed austenite.
Back into the sponge.
And this is key. It saturates that residual austenite. And when austenite gets full of carbon, it becomes incredibly stable. It doesn't want to change anymore.
So instead of steel plus brittle carbides, we end up with a mix.
Right.
We get the bainitic ferrite, which gives us the strength interwoven with this carbon-rich austenite.
Which gives us the toughness. Hmm? Because austenite is ductile. It can absorb energy. So you've got a composite material, hard spines of ferrite cushioned by soft pockets of austenite.
That sounds great in theory. But making it happen isn't just about dumping silicon in a pot.
No.
The paper dives into some heavy thermodynamics here. They talk about something called the incomplete reaction phenomenon.
Yeah, this is where the science gets really elegant.
To me, incomplete reaction sounds like a failure. Like baking a cake and taking it out halfway. Why is incomplete a good thing here?
Because we need that austenite to survive.
Mm.
Usually, if you let the reaction finish to completion, all the austenite turns into ferrite and carbides.
Okay.
We want the reaction to stop halfway, so we keep some of that austenite to act as the cushion.
And what stops it? Is it just running out of heat or timing it with a stopwatch?
No, and that's the beauty of it. It's the laws of physics putting up a stop sign. This is the T0 curve mentioned in the paper.
The T0 curve. I saw the charts, and they look pretty intimidating. Break that down for us without the calculus.
Sure. Think of the T0 curve as a thermodynamic limit line. It's the point where the energy balance shifts. As the bainite grows, it keeps pumping carbon into the remaining austenite. The austenite gets richer and richer in carbon.
Okay, so the carbon concentration is rising.
Right.
Like adding more and more sugar to tea.
Eventually, the austenite gets so stuffed with carbon that it becomes thermodynamically impossible for it to turn into ferrite. It crosses that T0 limit.
So the reaction literally chokes itself off.
Chokes itself off. The free energy of the two phases equalizes, and the reaction just stops.
So it's not that the process ran out of time. It's that the chemistry said, I'm full. No more transformation.
Correct. And what's brilliant about this paper is that Padicia and Edmonds show that this is entirely predictive. If you know the chemical composition.
How much carbon, manganese, silicon.
All of it. You can calculate exactly where that limit is.
That's a huge shift. It turns metallurgy from cook it and look at it into a predictive design science.
Absolutely.
You're designing the microstructure on a calculator before you melt a single gram of iron.
Exactly. You're manipulating the atoms by setting the boundaries of the game. You aren't just crossing your fingers and hoping for a good alloy.
So let's talk about the game they actually played. They created a specific mix called Alloy A.
Alloy A. Not the most creative name, but effective.
It sounds like a secret government project from the 80s. So Alloy A is iron, 0.43% carbon, 3% manganese, and specifically 2.02% silicon.
That 2% silicon is the magic number. That's high enough to trigger that no carbide rule we talked about.
And they took this alloy A and treated it at two different temperatures. And this is where the story turns into a bit of a Goldilocks scenario.
It really is.
The tale of two temperatures.
Right. Because even with the right ingredients, the silicon, the carbon, you can still mess up the cake if the oven is wrong.
First, they cooked it at 360 degrees C. This formed what they call upper bainite. What did that look like under the microscope?
At 360 degrees C, the microstructure was, well, let's call it blocky. Imagine looking under a microscope. You see these sheaves of bainite, and trapped between them are these large, irregular chunks or blocks of awe that retained austenite.
I thought we wanted retained austenite. We just spent 5 minutes talking about how it provides toughness.
We do want it, but we want the right kind. The blocky austenite at 360 degrees C turned out to be a disaster. When they did impact tests, those big blocks couldn't handle the stress. They were mechanically unstable.
So you hit the steel and the blocks. What? Collapse.
They snap. Specifically, they undergo a stress-induced transformation. They instantly turn into high-carbon martensite.
Martensite, that's the really hard stuff usually, right? Like in sword making?
It is, but high-carbon untempered martensite is extremely brittle. It's basically glass.
Oh.
So imagine your shock absorber suddenly turning into glass the moment you hit a bump.
It shatters.
Exactly. The cracks start in those brittle blocks and rip through the whole material. So the 360-degree sample failed. Low toughness.
Okay, so 360 degrees C is too hot. The blocks are bad news. Then they lower the thermostat to 295 degrees C.
Right.
This is lower bainite. What changed?
The geometry changed. This is the crucial insight. At 295 degrees C, the bainite plates grow differently. They are finer. And because they grow more densely, the remaining austenite doesn't get left in big chunks.
It gets squeezed.
It gets trapped as incredibly fine, thin films between the ferrite plates.
So instead of big chocolate chips, we have thin layers of chocolate in a croissant.
That is actually a fantastic analogy. A microscopic steel croissant. We're talking films that are barely visible.
And that changed everything.
Everything. When they tested the 295 degrees C samples, the toughness was incredible. It actually outperformed tempered martensite, which is the usual industry standard for high-strength steel.
Why? Why does the film shape work when the block shape failed? They're chemically the same stuff, right?
Chemically, yes. Mechanically, no. The paper explains that because the films are so thin and constrained by the hard ferrite on both sides, they are mechanically stable.
Okay.
They don't just flip into brittle martensite the moment you look at them wrong.
They can take a punch?
They can take a massive punch. They deform, they absorb the energy, but they don't shatter. They act as true shock absorbers.
And the paper didn't just claim this. They proved it with some serious stress tests. This part blew my mind.
They really did. They took the 295 degree C steel and stressed it to 100,000 meganewtons per square meter.
Just for context, that is an insane amount of pressure.
It is.
That's like balancing a few elephants on a postage stamp.
Pretty much. And crucially, after they applied that load, they looked at the steel under the microscope again. They examined thin foils of the material.
Yeah.
The films were still there. They hadn't transformed.
Wow.
In the 360 degree C blocky samples, the austenite was gone. It had all popped into brittle martensite, causing failure. But in the 295 degree C film samples, the austenite held the line.
So the secret recipe isn't just add silicon. It's add silicon and cook at a low enough temperature to squish the austenite into films.
Precisely. It's a composition property relationship mediated by microstructure. You need the chemistry to enable the physics and the physics to create the geometry.
Let's zoom out a bit. Why should the average listener care about this? I mean, it's fascinating science, but why does it matter if our steel has films or blocks?
It matters because of cost and efficiency. Look at the ingredients of alloy A again. Iron, carbon, manganese, silicon.
That sounds like a shopping list from a discount store.
It is. If you look at other high-performance steels that achieve this level of strength and toughness, they usually rely on expensive alloying elements.
Right. Nickel, chromium, molybdenum.
Which are pricey and sometimes subject to supply chain issues.
Sure.
Exactly. Silicon and manganese are dirt cheap. They are abundant. So Fidescia and Edmonds weren't just showing a cool physics trick. They were demonstrating a way to make super steel at a fraction of the cost.
It's the poor man's aerospace material.
In a way, yes. The paper describes it almost like a natural composite material. You've created a duplex alloy two phases working together that is cleaner because you've eliminated the carbides.
I want to double check something because we keep saying it's tough and bendable, but is it actually hard? Are we sacrificing the strength?
Ugh, it's hard. The data for the 295 degree C sample showed a hardness of about 447 HV.
Vickers hardness. Okay, give us a benchmark. Is that harder than a standard nail?
Much harder. A standard nail is maybe 150 HV. High-strength structural steel might be 250, 300.
So 447 is.
447 is approaching tool steel levels. And usually, at that hardness, steel would be terrifyingly brittle. You hit it with a hammer, it would fly apart. Here, it maintains toughness.
It's having your cake and eating it too.
In metallurgy, that is the holy grail.
I also noticed they validated the model in a really interesting way. They measured the carbon content inside those tiny films.
Yes, this loops back to the T0 curve. Their mathematical model predicted exactly how much carbon should be trapped in that austenite to make the reaction stop.
and when they measured it with x-rays.
It matched. The experimental data lined up with the theoretical prediction, and that high carbon content is what chemically stabilizes the austenite at room temperature.
It was a beautiful confirmation.
It really was. They didn't just stumble upon this. They calculated it, predicted it, and then built it.
And they proved that the hardness wasn't coming from martensite.
Right. They did step-quenching experiments to prove that the strength was coming from the Benedict ferrite itself, which is incredibly fine-grained and full of dislocations.
A tangled mess of crystal defects.
Basically, yeah. A mess that makes it strong supported by those tough austenite films.
So this was part one. This paper was published in 1983. What was the legacy of this study? Did it get out into the world?
It absolutely got out. This paper effectively opened the door to the entire field of carbide-free bainite.
Oh.
Today, you see variations of this, sometimes called super bainite or nanostructured bainite, being investigated for things like rail tracks, armor plating, and high-strength automotive parts.
Things that need to take a beating but can't fail.
Exactly. And it all goes back to this fundamental understanding. You can suppress carbides with silicon, and you can stabilize austenite if you get the geometry right.
It's wild to think that adding a little sand, which is basically what silicon is, and changing the thermostat by 65 degrees makes the difference between a material that shatters like glass and one that could stop a bullet.
That is the beauty of material science. Small changes on the atomic scale have massive consequences on the macro scale.
So to wrap this up, we've covered a lot of ground. We started with the idea that steel is a battlefield.
Mm-hmm.
We learned that conventional bainite has a weakness. Brittle carbides.
And we learned the solution. Silicon, the bouncer that kicks the carbides out.
But that was only half the battle. We also learned that shape matters.
Crucially, large blocks of austenite are unstable and dangerous. Thin films are stable and protective.
And finally, we saw that this approach using thermodynamics to predict the outcome allows us to use cheap ingredients to make superior materials.
A triumph of theory applied to practice.
Here's a thought that stuck with me while reading this. For decades, metallurgists looked at retained austenite in this type of steel as a failure. It was the incomplete reaction. It was viewed as a flaw to be eliminated.
That's true. In many other contexts, retained austenite was the enemy.
But Fedaishi and Edmonds proved that it wasn't the phase itself that was the problem. It was the context.
Right.
It was the shape and location. If you flatten it into films, the flaw becomes the feature that gives the steel its superpower.
That's a profound point. It's not about the material being good or bad. It's about how it's arranged.
It makes you wonder what other flaws in our current technology, or even in our understanding of science, are actually just features waiting for the right geometric configuration to be useful.
That is the question that drives innovation. Maybe the waste product of today is the supermaterial of tomorrow, if we just look at it through a different lens.
Something to chew on next time you walk past a construction site. Thanks for diving deep with us today.
A pleasure as always.
We'll see you next time.